In 1474, Venetian monk and scribe Filippo de Strada issued a polemic against another handheld information device stating, quote, "The printing press is a whore!" An 1883 medical journal attributed rising rates of suicide and homicide to the new educational craze, proclaiming, quote, "Insanity is increasing with education," and that education would, quote, "exhaust the children's brains and nervous systems." In 1936, kids were said to, quote, "have developed the habit of dividing attention between the humdrum preparation of their school assignment and the compelling excitement of the radio loudspeaker," according to Gramophone, the music magazine. It seems hard to believe that these benign developments scared anyone. But technological leaps are often followed by moral panics. Quote, "Each successive historical age has ardently believed that an unprecedented crisis in youth behavior is taking place," Oxford historian Abigail Wills writes in an article for BBC's online history magazine. Quote, "We are not unique. Our fears do not differ significantly from those of our predecessors." When it comes to the undesirable behavior of children today, convenient myths about devices are just as dubious as the blame parents deflect onto sugar highs, underdeveloped teen brains, and other technologies like the book and the radio. Many experts believe the discussion regarding whether tech is harmful is more nuanced than alarmists led on. In a rebuttal to the article that claimed that children are on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades, Sarah Rose Kavanaugh wrote in Psychology Today that, quote, "the data the author chooses to present are cherry-picked, by which I mean she reviews only those studies that support her idea and ignores studies that suggest that screen use is not associated with outcomes like depression and loneliness." One of many studies not cherry-picked was conducted by Christopher Ferguson and published in Psychiatric Quarterly. It found only a negligible relationship between screen time and depression. Ferguson wrote in an article in Science Daily, quote, "although an everything in moderation message when discussing screen time with parents may be most productive, our results do not support a strong focus on screen time as a preventative measure for youth problem behaviors." As so often is the case, the devil is in the digital details. A closer read of the studies linking screen time with depression finds correlation only with extreme amounts of time spent online. Teenage girls who spent over 5 hours per day online tended to have more depressive or suicidal thoughts. But common sense would have us ask whether the kids who have a propensity to spend excessive amounts of time online might also have other problems in their lives. Perhaps 5 hours a day of any form of media is a symptom of a larger problem. In fact, the same study found that kids who spent 2 hours or less online per day did not have higher rates of depression and anxiety compared to controls. A study conducted at the Oxford Internet Institute found that mental well-being actually increased with moderate amounts of screen time. Quote, "even at exceptional levels, we're talking about a very small impact. It's about a third as bad as missing breakfast or not getting 8 hours of sleep." When kids act in ways we don't like, parents desperately ask, "why is my kid acting this way?" There's certainty in a scapegoat, and we often cling to simple answers because they serve a story we want to believe, that kids do strange things because of something outside our control, which means that those behaviors are not really their or our fault. Of course, technology plays a role. Smartphone apps and video games are designed to be engaging, just as sugar is meant to be delicious. But like the parents who blame a sugar high for their kids' bad behavior, blaming devices is a surface-level answer to a deeper question. Easy answers mean we can avoid having to look into the dark and complex truth underlying why kids behave the way they do. But we can't fix the problem unless we look at it clearly, free of media-hyped myths, to understand the root causes. Parents don't need to believe tech is evil to help kids manage distraction. Learning to become indistractable is a skill that will serve our children no matter what life path they pursue or what forms distraction takes. If we are going to help our kids take responsibility for their choices, we need to stop making convenient excuses for them and for ourselves. In this section, we're going to understand the deeper psychology driving some kids to overuse their devices and learn smart ways to help them overcome distraction. Remember this. Stop deflecting blame. When kids don't act the way parents want, it's natural to look for answers that help parents divert responsibility. Techno panics are nothing new. From the book, to the radio, to video games, the history of parenting is strewn with moral panic over things supposedly making kids act in strange ways. Tech isn't evil. Used in the right way and in the right amounts, kids' tech use can be beneficial, while too much or too little can have slightly harmful effects. Teach kids to be indistractable. Teaching children how to manage distraction will benefit them throughout their lives. Chapter 30. Understand their internal triggers. Richard Ryan and his colleague Edward Deci are two of the most cited researchers in the world on the drivers of human behavior. Their self-determination theory is widely regarded as the backbone of psychological well-being, and countless studies have supported their conclusions since they began research in the 1970s. Just as the human body requires three macronutrients, protein, carbohydrates, and fat, to run properly, Ryan and Deci propose the human psyche needs three things to flourish: autonomy, competence, and relatedness. When the body is starved, it elicits hunger pangs. When the psyche is undernourished, it produces anxiety, restlessness, and other symptoms that something is missing. When kids aren't getting the psychological nutrients they need, self-determination theory explains why they might overdo unhealthy behaviors, such as spending too much time in front of screens. Ryan believes the cause has less to do with the devices and more to do with why certain kids are susceptible to distraction in the first place. Without sufficient amounts of autonomy, competence, and relatedness, kids turn to distraction for psychological nourishment. Lesson 1. Kids need autonomy, volition, and freedom of control over their choices. Maricela Correa Chavez and Barbara Rogoff, professors at the University of California, Santa Cruz, conducted an experiment in which two children were brought into a room where an adult taught one of them how to build a toy while the other one waited. The study was designed to observe what the non-participating child, the observer, would do while they waited. In America, most of the observer children did what you'd expect them to do. They shuffled in their seats, stared at the floor, and generally showed signs of disinterest. One impatient boy even pretended a toy was a bomb and threw his hands in the air to mimic an explosion, making loud, disruptive noises to match the carnage. In contrast, the researchers found that Mayan children from Guatemala concentrated on what the other child was learning and sat still in their chairs as the adult taught the other child. Overall, the study found that American children could focus for only half as long as Mayan kids. Even more interesting was the finding that the Mayan children, with less exposure to formal education, quote, showed more sustained attention and learning than their counterparts from Mayan families with extensive involvement in Western schooling. In other words, less schooling meant more focus. How could that be? Psychologist Susan Gaskin has studied Mayan villages for decades and told NPR that Mayan parents give their kids a tremendous amount of freedom. Quote, rather than having the mom set the goal and then having to offer enticements and rewards to reach that goal, the child is setting the goal. Then the parents support that goal however they can, Gaskin said. Mayan parents, quote, feel very strongly that every child knows best what they want, and that goals can be achieved only when a child wants it. Most formal schooling in America and similar industrialized countries, on the other hand, is the antithesis of a place where kids have the autonomy to make their own choices. According to Rogoff, quote, It may be the case that children give up control of their attention when it's always managed by an adult. In other words, kids can become conditioned to lose control of their attention and become highly distractible as a result. Ryan's research reveals exactly where we lose kids' attention. Quote, whenever children enter middle school, whenever they start leaving home-based classrooms and go into the more police state style of schools, where bells are ringing, detentions are happening, punishment is occurring, they're learning right then that this is not an intrinsically motivating environment, he says. Robert Epstein, the researcher who wrote the Myth of the Teen Brain article in Scientific American, has a similar conclusion. Quote, surveys I have conducted show that teens in the U.S. are subjected to more than 10 times as many restrictions as our mainstream adults. Twice as many restrictions as active duty U.S. Marines, and even twice as many restrictions as incarcerated felons. While such a restrictive environment isn't every American student's experience, it's clear why so many struggle to stay motivated in the classroom. Their need for autonomy to explore their interests is unfulfilled. Quote, we're doing a lot of controlling them in their school environments, and it's no surprise that they should then want to turn to an environment where they can feel a lot of agency and a lot of autonomy in what they're doing, Ryan says. Quote, we think of tech use as a kind of evil in the world, but it's an evil we have created a gravitational pull around by the alternatives we've set up. Unlike their offline lives, kids have a tremendous amount of freedom online. They have the autonomy to call the shots and experiment with creative strategies to solve problems. Quote, in internet spaces, there tends to be myriad choices and opportunities, and a lot less adult control and surveillance, says Ryan. Quote, one can thus feel freedom, competence, and connection online, especially when the teenager's contrasting environments are overly controlling, restrictive, or understimulating. Ironically, when parents grow concerned with how much time their kids spend online, they often impose even more rules, a tactic that tends to backfire. Instead of more ways to limit your kids' autonomy, Ryan advises seeking to understand the underlying needs and associated internal triggers driving them to digital distraction. Quote, what we've found is that parents who address internet use or screen time with their kids in an autonomy-supported way have kids who are more self-regulated with respect to it, so less likely to use screen time for excessive hours, he says. Lesson 2. Children strive for competence, mastery, progression, achievement, and growth. Think about something you're good at. Your ability to present on stage, pull together a delicious meal, or parallel park in the tightest of spaces. Competence feels good, and that feeling grows alongside your ability. Unfortunately, the joy of progress in the classroom is a waning feeling among kids today. Ryan warns, quote, we're giving messages of you're not competent at what you're doing at school to so many kids. He points to the rise of standardized testing as part of the problem. Quote, it's destroying classroom teaching practices. It's destroying the self-esteem of so many kids, and it's killing their learning and motivation. Kids are so different, and their developmental rates are so variable, Ryan says. However, by design, standardized tests don't account for these differences. If a child isn't doing well in school and doesn't get the necessary individualized support, they start to believe that achieving competence is impossible, so they stop trying. In the absence of competency in the classroom, kids turn to other outlets to experience the feeling of growth and development. Companies making games, apps, and other potential distractions are happy to fill that void by selling ready-made solutions for the psychological nutrients kids lack. Tech makers know how much consumers enjoy leveling up, gaining more followers, or getting likes. Those accomplishments provide the fast feedback of achievement that feels good. According to Ryan, when children spend time in school doing something they don't enjoy, they don't value, and don't see potential for improvement, quote, it should be no surprise to us that at nighttime, they would rather turn to an activity where they can feel a lot of competence. Lesson 3. They seek relatedness, feeling important to others and that others are important to them. Spending time with peers has always been a formative part of growing up. For kids, much of the opportunity to develop social skills centers around chances to play with others. In today's world, however, teens increasingly experience social interactions in virtual environments because doing so in the real world is inconvenient or off-limits. The very nature of play is rapidly changing. Remember playing pickup games at the basketball court, hanging out at the mall on weekends, or simply roaming around the neighborhood until you found a friend? Sadly, spontaneous socializing simply isn't happening as much as it used to. As Peter Gray, who has studied the decline of play in America, wrote in the American Journal of Play, quote, "It is hard to find groups of children outdoors at all, and if you do find them, they are likely to be wearing uniforms and following the directions of coaches. Whereas previous generations were allowed to simply play after school and form close social bonds, many children today are raised by parents who restrict outdoor play because of child predators, road traffic, and bullies," according to a survey of parents in an Atlantic article. These concerns were mentioned even though kids today are statistically the safest generation in American history. Unfortunately, this is a downward spiral that leaves many kids with no choice but to stay indoors, attend structured programs, or rely on technology to find and connect with others. In many ways, connecting in digital environments can be very positive. A child who is bullied at school can reach out for help from supportive online friends. A teenager struggling with their sexuality can find support from someone on the other side of the country. And a kid who feels shy at school can be a hero among their gaming friends from all corners of the world. Quote, "What the data shows," says Ryan, "is that kids who aren't feeling relatedness, who are feeling isolated or excluded in school, are going to be more drawn to media where they can get connection from other people and find subgroups they can identify with. So that's both a plus and a minus." The loss of in-person play has real costs, according to Gray. Given that, quote, "learning to get along and cooperate with others as equals may be the most crucial evolutionary function of human social play," he sees it as, quote, "both a consequence and a cause of the increased social isolation and loneliness in the culture." Long before studies correlated screen time with rising rates of depression, Gray identified a much bigger trend that dated back over 60 years. Gray wrote, "Since about 1955, children's free play has been continually declining, at least partially because adults have exerted ever-increasing control over children's activities. Somehow, as a society, we have come to the conclusion that to protect children from danger and to educate them, we must deprive them of the very activity that makes them happiest and place them for ever more hours in settings where they are more or less continually directed and evaluated by adults, settings almost designed to produce anxiety and depression." When considering the state of modern childhood, Ryan believes many kids aren't getting enough of the three essential psychological nutrients, autonomy, competence, and relatedness, in their offline lives. Not surprisingly, our kids go looking for substitutes online. Quote, "We call this the need density hypothesis," says Ryan. "The more you're not getting needs satisfied in life, reciprocally, the more you're going to get them satisfied in virtual realities." Ryan's research leads him to believe that, quote, "overuse of technology is a symptom, one indicative of some emptiness in other areas of life, like school and home. When these three needs are met, people are more motivated, perform better, persist longer, and exhibit greater creativity." Ryan isn't against setting limits on tech use, but thinks such limits should be set with the child and not arbitrarily enforced because you think you know best. Quote, "Part of what you want your kid to get from this is not just less screen time, but an understanding of why," he says. "The more you talk with your kids about the costs of too much tech use, and the more you make decisions with them as opposed to for them, the more willing they will be to listen to your guidance." We can start by sharing some of the coping and reimagining tactics we learned in part one. Let your children know what you're doing differently in your own life to manage distraction. Being vulnerable and showing kids that we understand their struggle and face similar challenges helps build trust. Just as we saw in the previous section how good bosses model disconnecting from distraction, parents should model how to be indistractable. We may also want to consider providing real-world opportunities for children to find the autonomy, competence, and relatedness they need. Easing up on structured academic or athletic activities and giving them more time for free play may help them find the connections they otherwise look for online. We can't solve all of our kids' troubles, nor should we attempt to, but we can try to better understand their struggles through the lens of their psychological needs. Knowing what's really driving their overuse of technology is the first step to helping kids build resilience instead of escaping discomfort through distraction. Once our kids feel understood, they can begin planning how to best spend their time. Remember this. Internal triggers drive behavior. To understand how to help kids manage distraction, we need to start by understanding the source of the problem. Our kids need psychological nutrients. According to a widely accepted theory of human motivation, all people need three things to thrive: a sense of autonomy, competence, and relatedness. Distractions satisfy deficiencies. When our kids' psychological needs are not met in the real world, they go looking for satisfaction, often in virtual environments. Kids need alternatives. Parents and guardians can take steps to help kids find balance between their online and offline worlds by providing more offline opportunities to find autonomy, competence, and relatedness. The four-part indistractable model is valuable for kids as well. Teach them methods for handling distraction and, most important, model being indistractable yourself. Chapter 31. Make time for traction together. When it comes to helping our kids manage distraction, it's important to make the conversation about people rather than tech. That's according to Lori Goetz, the founder of Cyber Education Consultants, which hosts internet safety workshops in schools. It's a lesson she learned in her own childhood. Goetz got her first phone, a corded one, in her room as a teenager. The moment she got it, she closed the door and spent the entire weekend locked in her room, talking with friends instead of spending time with her family. When she got home from school the next Monday, her door had been taken off its hinges. "It's not the phone's fault you're behaving like an a-hole," her father chided her. "You closed the door and you closed all of us out." While Goetz doesn't recommend her father's aggressive tactics or tone, his focus on the effect her behavior had on others rather than the phone itself proved instructive. Quote, "Make the conversation about how you're treating and interacting with the people around you," she advises, as opposed to blaming the tool. When it comes to how we spend time together as a family, the important thing is to define what constitutes traction versus distraction. A recent Goetz family vacation put her theory to the test. Her 6 and 11-year-old daughters asked if they could use their phones during the 2-hour ride from Sacramento to Truckee. Motivated by a desire to ease the monotony of the ride, as well as the opportunity for a quiet conversation with her husband, Goetz agreed. The device time made the long drive easier, but later in the vacation, Goetz noticed her daughters started turning to their devices a bit too much. The girls' tech overuse came to a head when Goetz returned from a run to find her kids glued to their screens. Neither was ready to leave for their family outing as had been agreed upon. Rather than losing her cool and punitively announcing strict house rules around the kids' use of devices, Goetz decided it was time for a family talk. During the family huddle, they all confirmed their desire to spend quality time together, aka traction. By agreeing upon how they wanted to spend their time and what needed to get done, it became clear that doing anything else was a distraction interfering with their plans. They decided as a family that they could use their devices only after they were 100% ready to go. Goetz acknowledges that admitting you don't have all the answers is a great way to involve the kids in finding new solutions. Quote, We're all figuring it out as we go along, she says. Goetz wants her daughters to continue to ask themselves questions to self-monitor and self-regulate their behavior. Quote, is my behavior working for me? Am I proud of myself in the way I'm behaving? She asks them to ask themselves. Quote, I work with a lot of teenagers who will often tell me that they don't want to be distracted. They don't want to be sucked into all this stuff, but they just don't know how to stop. To help children learn self-regulation, we must teach them how to make time for traction. We can encourage regular discussions about our values and theirs, and teach them how to set aside time to be the people they want to be. Keep in mind that while it's easy for us to think, hey, kids have all the time in the world, it's important to remember that they have their own priorities within each of their life domains. Working with our kids to create a values-based schedule can help them make time for their personal health and wellness domain, ensuring ample time for rest, hygiene, exercise, and proper nourishment. For example, while my wife and I don't enforce a strict bedtime for our daughter, we made it a point to expose her to research findings showing the importance of ample sleep during adolescent years. After she realized that sleep was important for her well-being, it didn't take much for her to conclude that screen time after 9 p.m. on a school night was a bad idea, a distraction from her value of staying healthy. As you guessed, she time-boxed periods of rest in her day. While she may occasionally find herself deviating from this evening appointment with her pillow, having it in her schedule provides her with a self-imposed guideline to self-monitor, self-regulate, and ultimately live out her values. When it comes to the work domain in kids' lives, for the typical American child, work is synonymous with school-related responsibilities and household chores. While school schedules provide a timetable for a child's daytime hours, how they spend their time after school can be a source of disagreement and frustration. Without a clear plan, many kids are left to make impulsive decisions that often involve digital distraction. I recently had coffee with a friend who is the mother of twin teenage boys. She bemoaned the mind-altering influence of her kids' obsession with the latest techno villain, the online game Fortnite. They can't stop, she told me. She was convinced the game was addictive and her kids were junkies. Every evening involved fights to get them to stop playing and finish their homework. Exasperated, she asked me what I thought she should do. My advice involved a few unorthodox ideas. First, I advised her to have a conversation with her sons and listen to them without judgment. Potential questions to ask included the following. Is keeping up with their schoolwork consistent with their values? Do they know why they are asked to do their homework? What are the consequences of not doing their assignments? Are they okay with those consequences, both short-term, getting a bad grade, and long-term, settling for a low-skilled job? Without their agreement that schoolwork mattered to them, forcing them to do something they didn't want to do amounted to coercion and would only breed resentment. But if I don't hound my kids, they'll fail, she objected. So, I asked, if the only reason they study is to get you off their backs, what are they going to do when they go to college or start a job and you're not around? Maybe they need to know what failure feels like sooner rather than later. I advised her that teenagers are generally old enough to make decisions about how they spend their time. If that means flunking a test, then so be it. Coercion may be a band-aid solution, but it is certainly not a remedy. Next, I proposed she ask them to suggest how much time they'd like to spend on various activities, such as studying, being with friends or family, or playing Fortnite. I warned that while she may not like her kids' answers, it's important to honor their input. The goal here is to teach them to spend their time mindfully by reserving a place for important activities on their weekly schedules. Remember, their schedules, like ours, should be assessed and adjusted weekly to ensure that their time is spent living out their values. Playing Fortnite, for instance, is fine if the time has been allocated to it in advance. With a time box schedule that includes time for digital devices, kids know that they'll have time to do the things that they enjoy. I advised her to change the context of her family conversations around tech, from screaming no to teaching kids to tell themselves, not yet. Empowering children with the autonomy to control their time is a tremendous gift. Even if they fail from time to time, failure is part of the learning process. Last, I advised her to make sure her kids' days include plenty of time for play, both with their friends and with their parents. Her boys were using Fortnite to have fun with their buddies and would continue to play online without an offline alternative. If we want our kids to fulfill their need for relatedness offline, they need time to build face-to-face friendships outside school. These relationships should be free from the pressures of coaches, teachers, and parents telling them what to do. Unfortunately, for the typical child these days, playtime won't happen unless it's scheduled. Conscious parents can bring back playtime for kids of all ages by deliberately making time in their weekly schedules and seeking out other parents who understand the importance of unstructured play and schedule regular get-togethers to let the kids hang out, just as you would make time for a jog in the park or a jam session in the garage. Research studies overwhelmingly support the importance of unstructured playtime on kids' ability to focus and to develop the capacity for social interactions. Given that, unstructured play is arguably their most important extracurricular activity. In addition to helping kids make time for unstructured play, we also need to carve out time for them to spend time with us, their parents. For example, scheduling family meals is perhaps the single most important thing parents and kids can do together. Studies demonstrate that children who eat regularly with their families show lower rates of drug use, depression, school problems, and eating disorders. Unfortunately, many families miss meals together because they play it by ear, a strategy that often leaves everyone eating alone on their own schedules. Hence, it's better to set aside an evening, even if only once a week, for a device-free family meal. As our kids develop, we can invite them to shape these family meal experiences by suggesting menu themes like Finger Food Fridays, cooking together, or contributing conversation topics. As a family, play can and should extend beyond mealtimes. In my household, we've established a weekly Sunday Fun Day, where we rotate the responsibility to plan a 3-hour activity. When it's my turn, I might take the family to the park for a long conversation while we walk. My daughter typically requests to play a board game when it's her turn to pick. My wife often proposes a trip to a local farmer's market to discover and sample new foods. Whatever the choice, the idea is to regularly set aside time together to feed our need for relatedness. While we must prepare to make adjustments to our family schedule, we need to involve our kids in setting our routines and honoring our commitments to each other. Teaching them to make their own schedules and being indistractable together helps us pass on our values. Remember this. Teach traction. With so many potential distractions in kids' lives, teaching them how to make time for traction is critical. Just as with our own time-boxed schedules, kids need to learn how to make time for what's important to them. If they don't learn to make their own plans in advance, kids will turn to distractions. It's okay to let your kids fail. Failure is how we learn. Show kids how to adjust their schedules to make time to live up to their values. Chapter 32. Help them with external triggers. After understanding the internal triggers driving kids to distraction and helping them create a schedule using the time boxing technique, the next step is to examine the external triggers in their lives. In many ways, it's easy to blame the explosion of unwelcome cues tugging at our kids' attention. With their phones buzzing, the television flickering, and music blaring into their earbuds, it's difficult to understand how our kids are able to get anything done. Many kids and adults pass their days mentally swinging from one thing to the next. Constantly reacting to external triggers, children are left with few opportunities to think deeply and concentrate on anything for long. According to a 2015 Pew Research Center study looking at youth and technology in the United States, quote, 95% of teens now report they have a smartphone or access to one. Not surprisingly, 72% of parents whose kids have a smartphone are concerned they, quote, pose too much distraction. In many ways, it is parents and guardians who have enabled this situation. After all, we are the ones who gave permission and often provided the funds to purchase the distracting devices we've come to resent. We've bowed down to our kids' demands in ways that may not benefit them or our households. Many parents don't consider whether their children are ready for a device with potentially damaging consequences and give in to the protest that, "Everyone in my class has a smartphone and an Instagram account." As parents, we often forget that a kid wanting something really, really badly is not a good enough reason. Imagine a young child is standing at the edge of a swimming pool while their friends are all playing in the water and having a great time. The child desperately wants to jump in, but you're not sure whether they know how to swim. What would you do? We know swimming pools can be very dangerous, but despite the risks, we wouldn't keep our children from enjoying the water forever. Rather, once they are old enough, we'd make sure they learned how to swim. Even after they had the basics down, we'd still keep an eye on them until we were confident about their ability to enjoy the pool safely. In fact, we can easily think of a host of activities we wouldn't let our kids experience before they're ready. Reading certain books, watching violent films, driving a car, having an alcoholic drink, and of course, using digital devices. Each comes in its own time, not whenever a kid says so. Exploring the world and navigating its risks are an important part of growing up. But giving a kid a smartphone or other gadgetry before they have the faculties to use it properly is just as irresponsible as letting them jump headfirst into a pool without knowing how to swim. Many parents justify handing over smartphones in exchange for the peace of mind of knowing they can contact their child at any time. But unfortunately, they often find they've given their child too much too soon. The swimming pool analogy is useful here. When children learn to enjoy the water, they start in the shallow end. Perhaps they wear floaties or use a kickboard to help them get comfortable with the water. Only later, when they have demonstrated their competence, are they free to swim on their own. Instead of giving our kids a fully functional pinging and dinging smartphone, it's better to start with a feature phone that only makes calls and sends text messages. Such a phone can be purchased for less than $25 and does not come with the apps that can distract a child with external triggers. If location tracking is a priority, a GPS-enabled wristwatch like the Gizmo Watch keeps track of kids through an app on the parents' phones, but only allows incoming and outgoing calls to and from select numbers. As kids get older, a good test of whether they are ready for a particular device is their ability to understand and use the built-in settings for turning off external triggers. Do they know how to use the Do Not Disturb feature? Do they know how to set their phones to automatically turn off notifications when their schedule demands concentration? Are they able to place their phones out of sight and out of mind during family time or when friends come over? If not, they're not ready, and they need to take a few more swimming lessons, so to speak. Though parents tend to fixate on the latest technology craze, we often forget about older technologies, which can be just as much of a problem. There's little justification for allowing kids to have a television, laptop, or any other potentially distracting external trigger in their rooms. These screens should be kept in communal areas. The temptation to overuse these devices is too much to expect our kids to manage on their own, particularly in the absence of parental oversight. Kids also need plenty of sleep, and anything that flickers, beeps, or buzzes during the night is a distraction. Anya Kamenetz, author of The Art of Screen Time, writes that making sure kids get enough sleep is, quote, the one issue with the most incontrovertible evidence. Kamenetz strongly advises that, quote, screens and sleep don't mix, and implores parents to keep all digital devices out of kids' rooms at nighttime and to shut down screens at least an hour before bedtime. It's equally important to help our kids remove unwanted external triggers during activities like homework, chores, mealtime, playtime, and hobbies that require sustained attention. Just as you may ask your boss for time to focus at work, parents need to respect kids' scheduled time as well. If they're spending time on homework according to their time box schedule, we must, of course, minimize distraction. But the same rule applies to scheduled time with their friends or even playing video games. If they've made their plans in advance and with intent, it's your job to honor that plan and leave them alone. Recall the critical question, is this external trigger serving me or am I serving it? Sometimes as parents, we can be the source of distraction. The dog barking, the doorbell ringing, dad's subsequent command to answer the door, mom's question about the baseball team's game schedule, or a sibling's invitation to play can all interfere with the time schedules for something else. Though these interruptions seem trivial, any disturbance at the wrong time is a distraction, and we must do our part to help kids use their time as they planned by removing unwanted external triggers. remember this. Teach your children to swim before they dive in. Like swimming in a pool, children should not be allowed to partake in certain risky behaviors before they are ready. Test for tech readiness. A good measure of a child's readiness is the ability to manage distraction by using the settings on the device to turn off external triggers. Kids need sleep. There is little justification for having a television or other potential distractions in a kid's room overnight. Make sure nothing gets in the way of them getting good rest. Don't be the unwanted external trigger. Respect their time and don't interrupt them when they have scheduled time to focus on something, be that work or play. Chapter 33. Teach them to make their own pacts. When my daughter was 5 years old and already insisting on iPad time with unrelenting protests, my wife and I knew we had to act fast. After we all calmed down, we did our best to respect her needs in the way Richard Ryan recommends. We explained, as simply as we could, that too much screen time comes at the expense of other things. As a kindergartner, she was learning to tell time. So we could explain that there was only so much of it for things she enjoyed. Spending too much time with apps and videos meant less time to play with her friends at the park, swim at the community pool, or be with mom and dad. We also explained that the apps and videos on the iPad were made by some very smart people and were intentionally designed to keep her hooked and habitually watching. It's important that our kids understand the motives of the gaming companies and social networks. While these products sell fun and connection, they also profit from our time and attention. This might seem like a lot to teach a 5-year-old, but we felt a strong need to equip her with the ability to make decisions about her screen usage and enforce her own rules. It was her job to know when to stop because she couldn't rely upon the app makers or her parents to tell her when she'd had enough. We then asked her how much screen time per day she thought was good for her. We took a risk by giving her the autonomy to make the decision for herself, but it was worth a shot. Truthfully, I expected her to say, "All day!" But she didn't. Instead, armed with the logic behind why limiting screen time was important, and with the freedom to decide in her hands, she sheepishly asked for 2 shows. 2 episodes of a kid-appropriate program on Netflix is about 45 minutes, I explained. "Well, does 45 minutes seem like the right amount of screen time per day for you?" I asked. She nodded in agreement, and I could tell by the hint of a smile that she felt she had gotten the better end of the deal. As far as I was concerned, 45 minutes was fine with me, as it left plenty of time for other activities. "How do you plan to make sure you don't watch for more than 45 minutes per day?" I asked. Not wanting to lose the negotiation that she clearly felt she was winning, she proposed using a kitchen timer she could set herself. "Sounds good," I agreed. "But if mommy and daddy notice you're not able to keep the promise you made to yourself and to us, we'll have to revisit this discussion," I said. And she agreed. This is an example of how even young children can learn to use a pre-commitment. Today, as a spirited 10-year-old, my daughter is still in charge of her screen time. She's made some adjustments to her self-imposed guidelines as she's grown up, such as trading daily episodes for a weekend movie night. She's also replaced the kitchen timer with other tools. She now calls out to Amazon's Alexa to set a timer to let her know when she's reached her limit. The important thing is that these are her rules, not ours, and that she's in charge of enforcing them. Best of all, when her time is up, it's not her dad who has to be the bad guy. It's her device telling her she's had enough. Without realizing it, she entered into an effort pact, as described in Part 4. Many parents want to know if there's a correct amount of screen time kids should be allowed to spend on their screens, but no such absolute number exists. There are too many factors at play, including the child's specific needs, what the child is doing online, and the activities that the screen time is replacing. The most important thing is to involve the child in the conversation and help them set their own rules. When parents impose limits without their kids' input, they are setting them up to be resentful and incentivizing them to cheat the system. It's only when kids can monitor their own behavior that they learn the skills they need to be indistractable, even when their parents aren't around. These strategies are no guarantee of parent-child domestic harmony, In fact, we should expect to have heated discussions about the role technology plays in our homes and in our kids' lives, just as many families have fiery debates over giving the car keys to their teens on a Saturday night. Discussions and, at times, respectful disagreements are a sign of a healthy family. If there is one lesson to take away from this section, and perhaps this entire book, it's that distraction is a problem, like any other. Whether in a large corporation or in a small family, when we discuss our problems openly and in an environment where we feel safe and supported, we can resolve them together. One thing is for certain. Technology is becoming more pervasive and persuasive. While it's important our kids are aware that products are designed to be highly engaging, we also need to reinforce their belief in their own power to overcome distraction. It's their responsibility, as well as their right, to use their time wisely. Remember this. Don't underestimate your child's ability to pre-commit and follow through. Even young children can learn to use pre-commitments as long as they set the rules and know how to use a timer or some other binding system. Consumer skepticism is healthy. Understanding that companies are motivated to keep kids spending time watching or playing is an important part of teaching media literacy. Put the kids in charge. It's only when kids practice monitoring their own behavior that they learn how to manage their own time and attention. Part 7. How to Have Indistractable Relationships. Chapter 34. Spread Social Antibodies Among Friends. When we are with friends, we're never really alone in their company. Our phones are almost assuredly present and ready to interrupt us with a poorly timed notification. Who hasn't witnessed a friend lose attention mid-conversation to reflexively check a phone? Most of us simply accept these interruptions, sighing them away as a sign of the times. Unfortunately, distraction is contagious. When smokers get together, the first one to take out a pack sends a cue, and when others notice, they do the same. In a similar way, digital devices can prompt others' behavior. When one person takes out a phone at dinner, it acts as an external trigger. Soon, others are lost in their screens at the expense of the conversation. Psychologists call this phenomenon social contagion, and researchers have found that it influences our behavior from drug use to overeating. It's hard to watch your weight if your spouse and kids insist on mowing down a dozen frosted donuts as you pick at your kale salad. And it's difficult to change your tech habits when your family and friends shun you in favor of their screens. Given the enormous influence others have on our actions, how can we manage distraction around those with whom we want to spend uninterrupted quality time? How do we change our tendencies towards distraction when those around us haven't changed theirs? Essayist and investor Paul Graham writes that societies tend to develop what he calls social antibodies, defenses against new harmful behaviors. Consider that in 1965, according to the Centers for Disease Control, 42.4% of adult Americans smoked, a number that is expected to fall to just 12% by 2020. Of course, legal restrictions played an important role in the precipitous decline in smoking rates. However, laws do not prevent people from smoking in their homes, and yet that custom changed even in the absence of regulation. I remember my parents keeping ashtrays around the house in my childhood, despite being non-smokers. At the time, people smoked indoors, around children, and at the office, pretty much wherever they pleased. My mother did her best to discourage the smoking habit by providing an ashtray shaped like a bony skeleton hand. But that not-so-subtle reminder of the consequences of smoking was all she felt comfortable doing. In those days, it was considered strange, if not rude, to ask someone to smoke outside your home. Today, however, things are very different. I've never owned an ashtray. No one has ever asked to smoke in my home. They already know the answer. It scares me to imagine the look on my wife's face if someone were to light up on our living room couch. That person wouldn't be in our house or in our circle of friends for long. How did the norms around smoking change so dramatically in the course of just one generation? According to Graham's theory, people adopted social antibodies to protect themselves, similar to the way our bodies fight back against bacteria and viruses that can harm us. The remedy for distraction in social situations involves the development of new norms that make it taboo to check one's phone when in the company of others. Social norms are changing, but whether they change for the better is up to us. The only way to make sure certain unhealthy behaviors are no longer acceptable is to call them out and address them with social antibodies that block their spread. This tactic worked with smoking, and it can work with digital distractions. Let's imagine you're at a dinner party when someone takes out his phone and starts to tap away. While you likely already know that spending time on a device in an intimate social setting is rude, there's often at least one person who hasn't learned the new social norm. Embarrassing him in front of others isn't a good idea, assuming you want to stay friends. A subtler tactic is required. To help keep things cordial, a simple and effective approach is to ask a direct question that can snap the offender out of the phone zone by giving him two simple options. One, either excuse himself to attend to the crisis happening on his device, or two, kindly put away his phone. The question goes like this. I see you're on your phone. Is everything okay? Remember to be sincere. After all, there might really be an emergency. But more often than not, he'll mutter a little excuse, tuck his phone back into his pocket, and start enjoying the night again. Victory is yours. You've succeeded in tactfully spreading the social antibody against fubbing, a word coined by the ad agency McCann for the McQuire Dictionary. Fubbing is a portmanteau of phone and snubbing, means, quote, to ignore a person or one's surroundings when in a social situation by busying oneself with a phone or other mobile device. The dictionary assembled experts to create the word in order to give people a way to call out the problem. Now it's up to us to start using the term so that it may become another positive social antibody in our arsenal against distractions in social settings. Modern technologies like smartphones, tablets, and laptops aren't the only sources of distraction in social situations. Many restaurants have wall-to-wall television sets, each with a different channel flashing headline news or a sports game that can easily disrupt conversations. Because of our acceptance of having televisions playing in the background in social settings, they can be equally, if not more, pernicious at distracting our attention away from the people we're with. Distraction among friends can take other forms, including our own children. For example, during a recent get-together, just as a good friend began to share his personal and professional struggles, one of his children came to the table and demanded a juice box. The conversation immediately shifted to the needs of the child. Such an innocent interruption has the ability to derail an important and sensitive conversation, the kind that solidifies close friendships. The next time we had dinner together, we made sure to put everything the kids would need, including food and drinks, in another room. The kids received clear instructions not to interrupt the adults unless someone was bleeding. All external triggers, whether coming from our phones or our kids, deserve scrutiny to determine whether they are serving us. Our children are also better served when they learn to take care of themselves. And by watching their parents model fellowship, they learn the importance of tuning out distraction to focus on friends. If we are not intentional about making the time and space for distraction-free discussions, we risk losing the opportunity to truly know others and allow them to truly know us. In the same way society reduced social smoking with social antibodies, we can reduce distraction while with friends. By getting agreement from our friends and families to manage distraction and taking steps to remove external triggers that don't serve us, we can quarantine the social contagion of distraction while with people we love. Remember this. Distraction in social situations can keep us from being fully present with important people in our lives. Interruptions degrade our ability to form close social bonds. Block the spread of unhealthy behaviors. Social antibodies are ways groups protect themselves from harmful behaviors by making them taboo. Develop new social norms. We can tackle distraction among friends the same way we beat social smoking, by making it unacceptable to use devices in social situations. Prepare a few tactful phrases like asking, "Is everything okay?" to discourage phone usage among friends. Chapter 35. Be an Indistractable Lover. Every night, my wife and I engaged in the same routine. She put our daughter to bed, brushed her teeth, and freshened up. Slipping under the covers, we exchanged glances and knew it was time to do what comes naturally for a couple in bed. She began to fondle her cell phone while I tenderly stroked the screen of my iPad. Ooh, it felt so good. We were having a love affair with our gadgets. Apparently, we weren't the only ones substituting Facebook for foreplay. According to one survey, quote, almost a third of Americans would rather give up sex for a year than part with their mobile phone for that long. Before we learned to become indistractable, the allure of notifications on our smartphones proved hard to resist. Promising to reply to just one more email after dinner quickly turned into 45 minutes of lost intimacy later that night. We'd fallen into an evening ritual of solitary tech checking until midnight. By the time we each got to bed, we were too tired to talk. Our relationship, not to mention our sex life, suffered. We were among the 65% of American adults who, according to the Pew Research Center, sleep with their phones on or next to their beds. Since habits rely on a cue to trigger a behavior, action is often sparked by the things around us. We decided to move our phones from our bedroom to our living room, and with the external triggers gone, we regained a bit more control over our techno-infidelity. But after a few phone-free evenings, I began to notice a stressful anxiety. My mind became occupied with all the things calling for my attention. Had someone sent me an urgent email? What was the latest comment on my blog about? Did I miss something important on Twitter? The stress was palpable and painful, so I did what anyone who makes a firm commitment to break a bad habit would do. I cheated. With my cell phone unavailable, I needed to find a new partner. To my relief, I felt the anxiety melt away as I pulled out my laptop and began to bang on the keyboard. My wife, seeing what I was doing, pounced on the opportunity to relieve her own stress, and we were back at it again. After a few late nights on our machines, we sheepishly admitted that we had failed. Embarrassed, but determined to understand where we'd gone wrong, we realized we had skipped a critical step. We hadn't learned to deal with the discomfort that had drawn us back in. With self-compassion, this time, we decided to start by finding ways to manage the internal triggers driving our unwanted behaviors. We implemented a 10-minute rule and promised that if we really wanted to use a device in the evening, we would wait 10 minutes before doing so. The rule allowed us time to surf the urge and insert a pause to interrupt the otherwise mindless habit. We also connected our internet router and monitors to $7 timer outlets purchased at a local hardware store and set them to turn off at 10 p.m. each night. Using this effort pact meant that in order to cheat, we would have to uncomfortably contort behind our desks and flip the override switch. In short, we were making progress by using all four methods of becoming indistractable. We learned to cope with the stress of stopping our compulsion to use technology in the evening, and over time, it became easier to resist. We scheduled a strict bedtime, claiming the bedroom as a sacred space and leaving external triggers like our cell phones and the television outside. The outlet timer that turned off the unwanted distractions made compliance with our pre-commitment something we came to expect every night. We began to use our reclaimed time for more productive purposes, and we gained greater control over our habits. Though we were proud of our tech-blocking invention, many routers like the Eero now come with internet shutoff capabilities built in. If I lose track of time and try to check email after 10 o'clock, a message from my router reminds me to get off the computer and go snuggle with my wife. Distractions can take a toll on even our most intimate relationships. The cost of being able to connect with anyone in the world is that we might not be fully present with the person physically next to us. My wife and I still love our gadgets and fully embrace the potential of innovation to improve our lives. But we want to benefit from technology without suffering from the corrosive effects it can have on our relationship. By learning to deal with our internal triggers, making time for the things we really want to do, removing harmful external triggers, and using pre-commitments, we were finally able to conquer distractions in our relationship. As you read in part one, being indistractable means striving to do what you say you will do. To strive means to struggle or fight vigorously. It does not mean being perfect or never failing. Like everyone, I still struggle with distraction at times. When I'm particularly stressed or my schedule changes unexpectedly, I can fall off track. Thankfully, the 5 years of researching and writing this book have taught me how to fight distraction and win. Distractions still happen, but now I know what to do about them so that they don't keep happening. These techniques have allowed me to take control of my life in ways I never could before. I'm as honest with myself as I am with others. I live up to my values. I fulfill my commitments to the people I love and am more professionally productive than ever. Recently, I revisited the conversation I'd had with my daughter about what superpower she'd want. After apologizing to her for not being fully present the last time we had the conversation, I asked her to tell me her answer again, and what she said blew me away. She said she wanted the power to always be kind to others. After drying my eyes and giving her a big hug, I took some time to think about her answer. I realized that being kind was not a mystical superpower that required a magical serum. We all have the power to be kind whenever we want to be. We simply need to harness the power that's already within us. The same is true for being indistractable. By becoming indistractable, we can set an example for others. In the workplace, we can use these tactics to transform our organizations and create a ripple effect both in and beyond our industries. At home, we can inspire our families to test these methods for themselves and live out the lives they envision. We can all strive to do what we say we will do. We all have the power to be indistractable. Remember this. Distractions can be an impediment in our most intimate relationships. Instant digital connectivity can come at the expense of being fully present with those beside us. Indistractable partners reclaim time for togetherness. Following the 4 steps to become indistractable can ensure you make time for your partner. Now it's your turn to become indistractable. Congratulations, and thank you for completing this audiobook. I hope you'll put what you've learned to good use. If you have a minute, it would mean so much to me if you would review this audiobook online. Your review goes a long way towards encouraging other people to listen to this audiobook, and I'd consider it a huge personal favor. Please go to nearandfar.com/review-indistractable. Remember, near is spelled like my first name, N-I-R, so that's nearandfar.com/review-indistractable. And please send any questions, comments, edits, or feedback to nearandfar.com/contact. Thank you so much.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. Written by Nir Eyal with Julie Lee. Performed by Nir Eyal. Executive producers Stacey Creamer and Mike Jarzik. Producer Chris Sacco. Copyright 2019 by Nir Eyal. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.